As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
Everybody, welcome to The Athletic Support, your podcast on the Montreal Canadiens. I am Marc-Antoine Godin, yes, back from the DL, and back right on time for after the season. Well, we're on May 4th, and Arpin Basu, hi to you. I'm happy to be back on this podcast.
Yes, welcome back on Star Wars Day, May the 4th. Yes, and so, yeah, good to have you back. You know, I gotta say, it's, you know, 3 weeks without you, I had to, you know, I lost my training wheels. I had to do the introduction in the podcast. I had to do what you just did.
Yeah, on three
episodes. It felt very weird. I felt like I was cheating on you. It was kind of like, you know, this is Marc-Antoine's gig. He's the one who says hello, everybody. And here I am saying hello, everybody. I felt bad, but I'm glad you're back. And I'm glad you're back to do the intro. And
no,
to,
that's fine.
And to talk
that's
about
my, that's my sole purpose, man.
Yeah, that's it. Now you can just be quiet and yeah, just kick your feet up and just hang out for the. I'm just going to talk for the rest of the time.
That's so Arpin. What about those Canadians?
Yeah,
okay, right. It's an introductory question.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, that's it.
But what about those Canadians?
Yeah, so the from what I could see from afar, I mean, I missed the exit meetings, the end of season availabilities, but plenty of interesting stuff though that I've was able to listen to after the fact, and I think that with all the Guy Lafleur, you know, news that were going on day after day, and all the articles that were being written, all the discourse around him, I think that some of the interesting stuff that's related to the Canadians fell a little bit under the radar, and Kent Hughes said a lot of interesting stuff in his end of season availability. So I think that's something that's pretty interesting that we could start with. Because, you know, with Carey Price coming back this year, I think this is a great story that he was able to play a few games, that he was finally able to provide some sort of hope. I think if only to show to himself that he was able to do it after, you know, going through the same process 5 or 6 years ago and not being able to come back and play a handful of games. He was able to do that this year, but at the same time, the fact that the Canadians go into the offseason not having more certainty about his health, and his future, I think that's something that's a bit of a blow to the whole organization, because that process ultimately, I think, was made in the design that if Carey Price was able to play some games and was able to convince himself and convince the organization that he was good to go and that there was some clarity on his future, it would help not only Price himself, but the whole front office in their offseason planning. But now, Kent Hughes is still pretty much at the same point, and Carey Price is still pretty much at the same point when it comes to preparing for next season, how his knee is going to hold up, will he be able to be a healthy contributor next year? So I think that everything starts with Carey Price, and it's a bit unfortunate to have to say this, because that's exactly what we were saying in the offseason last summer.
Yeah, it is very much, there's a lot of deja vu here with Carey Price, and particularly when it comes to his knee. You know, the last time he had to sit out basically the entire season, it was kind of the same situation. The same things were being said. Oh, the knee would be fine if he was a forward, but he's a goalie, and the goaltending position put strain and this and that. And you know, back then, what I was thinking, well, I was like, okay, well, this is an issue because, you know, you're a goalie. Like, if the goaltending position is putting strain on your knee and you're a goalie, then that's not a good combination. So here we are again. And, you know, I think this time, you know, Carey Price is pretty determined to find a solution here and work through it. And if that means another surgery, then so be it. But all he wants right now is to find a doctor who can definitively tell him something about his knee. And it's somewhat astonishing, I think, at this point that they can't find someone to do that. I mean, I'm no expert, but I mean, it doesn't seem that, you know, the fact that they can't find the reason why his knee continues swelling up every time he plays a game or when he puts it through any amount of strain. I mean, I think what became clear here is that he was playing games in spite of the fact that he knew that the knee was going to swell up. Like, that's the impression I got based on his answers on Saturday. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was just, I guess, to prove a point. And quite frankly, I think, especially the last game, it was like, well, if this is going to be, if I'm not going to find a solution to this, then I'd like to play at least this last game and say I did and have it play out the way it did. Obviously gave him, you know, I wouldn't say closure, but for him to say, you know, if that is it, it was a great way to go out. It's pretty striking to hear him talk in those terms, but that's the reality of it's the reality of his situation. So, you know, we don't want to belabor that point too much because, you know, that's obviously dominated all the coverage off the exit meetings. But you're right that it overshadowed, you know, a half hour of Kent Hughes talking about the future of this club and how they're going to go about it. And one thing that struck me, what you said is obviously 100% correct. They can't do anything until they know what's going on with Carey Price because it affects their entire payroll. I mean, basically, you either have a $10.5 million goalie who's going to play, or you have an additional $10.5 million in LTIR space with Carey Price being on it and Shea Weber being on it. And so assuming they can't trade him, which was interesting to hear Ken Hughes say that he still believes there's a market for him and that he's still going to try to trade him. One thing about that is if Carey Price is on LTIR anyway, what is the point of trading Shea Weber? It's just Carey Price affects so much because if you're going to be an LTIR, you might as well just be an LTIR and just own it and just keep, you know, and just go all in on LTIR because the only benefit of trading Shea Weber is to avoid LTIR so that you don't have to go into LTIR. And so for people who don't know, you know, long-term injured reserve is the mechanism in the CBA. This is where it's going to get a bit boring for a second, but just bear with me. But long-term injured reserve is the mechanism, obviously, that the Canadians have been in all season, allowing them to exceed the cap by X number of dollars, depending on, you know, where their payroll was on the moment the player hit LTIR. But the thing that it does is that it just makes everything a lot more rigid. It makes the salary cap a lot more rigid. It locks the Canadians in at a certain cap number. They can't bank cap space by sending people to the AHL. Everything gets locked in, essentially, as soon as they go into LTIR. So teams generally try to avoid that. But if you're going to be in it anyway, then if you're in it for $7.8 million or you're in it for $18.3 million, doesn't really make that much of a difference. Like, you know, it doesn't, it's trading Weber becomes a bit less of an issue if price is on LTIR. So that's just one thing that gets impacted.
But at the same time, the fact that can't use considers that there's still a possibility he might trade Weber suggests that he's not sold on the fact that price is going to end up on LTI. So he has to look at his options and say, in the event that price is able to play for us next season, then it's still relevant that we trade Weber.
Yeah, I said that if price is on LTIR, there's no point in trading Weber is what I said. And so if he's not, then yes, there is a benefit. And the other interesting part about that, and I think it applies to a lot of what Ken Hughes and Jeff Gorton intend on doing this summer, you know, there were all sorts of little hints during his half hour. So the one thing was that he completely kind of swept aside the notion that they should spend futures on gaining cap flexibility. Meaning that if you're going to trade with Shea Weber, you have to throw in a prospect or a draft pick in order for a team to take him.
If you want to trade Mike Hoffman, you're not going to attach a prospect like Ryan Poehling to make it happen.
Well, that's what he said. I mean, that's not what I would do, but that's what Ken Hughes said, is that he doesn't believe. Yeah. And I'm not sure if Ryan Poehling fits that, but he did mention that he doesn't think they're not going to do that. They're not going to alleviate their cap situation by spending draft capital or prospect capital to do it. And so that was interesting, because you mentioned Mike Hoffman. You mentioned you didn't mention Yoel Armia, but you could have. Yoel Armia would be someone else. Obviously, Shea Weber. You know, this is something. These contracts, it's hard to see a world in which they're trading these contracts away without doing that, unless they're bringing back a similarly problematic contract, kind of like the James Neal Milan Lucic trade from a few years ago. That's a possibility. Or you add a roster player that doesn't have like much of a future with the team, say a Jonathan Drouin who has 1 year left on his contract, or someone like that, someone, you know, a bit more of a veteran that's not in the future plans, and you tack that on, and maybe that allows a trade to happen. You know, it was still surprising for me to hear that he was so definitively come out and say that they're not going to do that. That they're just not willing to do that. So I think that kind of gives us a sense of what this offseason might be like for the Canadians. And it's not necessarily what I thought it would be like. Like, I thought cap flexibility was an do it at all costs kind of thing. And turns out it's not.
Yeah, probably it's just experiencing the market, having discussions with other GMs, gave them a better sense of where, you know, potential deals might be had or not. At what price do these deals come? And considering those factors, you know, there's been probably a readjustment in the strategy, because cap flexibility, I think, is something that they want to achieve, but it's not something that they want to achieve necessarily next year. And, you know, you mentioned Drouin. Drouin's in the last year of his contract. Byron's going to be in the last year of his contract. I suppose that by the end of next season, they'll know for sure what's going on with Price. They'll know they might have chosen to keep Weber on their LTI, or they will have moved him. But that clarity that they're looking for on their payroll, I think there's going to be more of it next year. And I don't think that they see themselves as a team being contending in any possible way next season. So what are they going to do with this? And when I look, and back to Price, when I first mentioned the case of Carey Price, is that in order to make those things happen, in order to make this team better, make these fine flexibility, how much room you want to give to your younger players, you have to decide at some point, how long are we going to take before we can move on with the decision on Price? Are we going to wait until free agency? Are we going to wait until the beginning of the season? But if they want others' dominoes to fall, they'll have to give themselves a deadline.
Well, there's, I mean, that's the frustrating thing about it in terms of from Ken Hughes' perspective is that you can't put a deadline on something that's so abstract. You know, like, I mean, this is a real mystery. It's a medical mystery at this point. No doctor that has examined Price's knee has any idea what's going on with his knee. You know, the surgeon in New York, and the reason Price went down there is, you know, basically to be like, what the hell's going on with my knee that you perform surgery on? And the way he described that visit, you know, we sat down for a little bit. He looked at some images and I didn't get any answers to my questions. So that didn't sound very promising. And so that's kind of, you know, Kent Hughes can be like, well, we have to know by this date. We have to know by that date. Well, how long is it going to take Carey Price and the Canadians to find some sort of medical opinion where they have any clarity whatsoever? Like a doctor who's willing to say, no, you should never play again, or a doctor that's willing to say, yes, I can fix this. Give me a chance to go in there and clean it up and you'll be good to go by training camp. They don't have, that person does not exist, or they have not found that person as of yet. So they can't. I would imagine there's some urgency because of the timeline we're talking about. Like in an ideal world, they would have this clarity, not next season, but by the draft. Like, I mean, this is really something right. if they want to plan their payroll, and if they want to execute trades and they want to do all sorts of things, that would be the ideal time. So that's 2 months away. In those 2 months, surely Carey Price and the Canadians and his agent or whoever's involved can find a doctor who can give him some sort of definitive answer on his knee, whether it's positive or negative. But as it stands now, with Shea Weber and Carey Price on the payroll and 15 other people on the payroll, the Canadians' payroll next season is $81.538 million on an $82.5 million salary cap. So they have they're a shade under $1 million on the salary cap. And I don't even know if that includes their bonus overage. I'm not sure if it does, but they're also getting dinged another 1 point something on bonus overages for all the bonuses collected by Caulfield and Suzuki and Romanov and even Jordan Harris, who got a games played bonus. So cap situation is very tight. Oh, it does include that. So it's very tight, and they can't really do anything until they know one way or another. So, but still, it was interesting to me, in spite of that, you know, Ken Hughes seemed to, you know, what you said earlier about them not thinking next year, and Ken Hughes has been clear about that. He's been clear that they don't even know if they'll make the playoffs next year, but their intention is not to be in the Connor Bedard conversation. Their intention is to be a competitive team who is not at the bottom of the standings, but is taking incremental steps towards being a winning team. That's what they would like, yeah, despite what some people would prefer with, you know, a
count
great
me
draft.
Among them.
Yeah, it's many people. And frankly, I'm on the fence on it. You know, I would say that too, because it just strikes me that, you know, this will be the third time the Canadians wind up with a top three pick in the draft in the last X number of years since Doug Wickenheiser, basically. And all three of those times was a lukewarm or so-so year in terms of talent coming out of the drafts. The Galchenyuk draft is one of the worst of the last, I don't know how many years, but it's really not a great draft, especially at the top. The Kotkaniemi draft is actually good, but, you know, they, you know, especially the player that was picked right after they picked, but, you know, it still was not a bumper crop in terms of, you know, in terms of depth of talent or what have you, but, you know, that turned out the way it did. And, you know, we're not going to relitigate the Jesperi Kotkaniemi draft pick, but it is what it is. That player is no longer in the organization. And now this year, they might end up with the number one pick, but they will at least have a top three pick. And it is, again, kind of a so-so year with so-so players available. So, but anyhow, sorry for that aside. But my point was that there were lots of little things Ken Hughes said that not only, you know, followed what you were saying, that they don't believe them, that they will be you know, a playoff team next year, but there was also like kind of some preparation of what they're willing to do and how next year is really not the plan. Their plan is for like 3 years from now. Like, so the one thing that really struck me was that, you know, he was asked about defense and what they intend on doing with all the, you know, with Gouley coming, Harris is already here, Romanov playing the legitimate top 4 minutes, top 2 minutes even on this team after Martin St. Louis arrived. And really, if Jeff Petrie gets traded, on Justin Barron as well, but if Jeff Petrie gets traded, your only two real veteran defensemen that you have are David Savard and Joel Edmondson. And are you willing to do that? And Kent Hughes was quite adamant, you know, that he does not see them throwing a bunch of rookies on defense and saying, oh, well, let's hope this works out kind of thing. And he called it a risk that they're not willing to take because he just wants players to be in their ideal development spot. And from the sounds of it, that's not an ideal development spot as far as Kent Hughes is concerned for their young defensemen. And the interesting part about it was that he thinks that there will be young players in the lineup on opening night, but they will not necessarily, they won't play 82 games. They will go down at times. Other players will come up and they'll get looks at a whole bunch of young players next season. But it just really gave the sense that this is being viewed by the organization. It's going to be managed by the organization as a transition year and that it should be evaluated as such.
Yeah. And he mentioned the fact that, yeah, young players could go down, be recalled, et cetera, on multiple occasions. And it reminds me a lot of the way the Ottawa Senators have been operating, not so much this year, but the year before and 2 years ago, where their slew of young players would be called up, have a taste, you know, for 10, 15 games, being sent down. Later on in the season, they'd be called up again to see how their progression is going. But that means that you need to have place fillers in the meantime, guys that are potentially like journeymen that can be pushed aside in order to make room for those younger players as the season progresses, or that will actually play if you want to limit the number of young players on your teams. So that's why you had Chris Weinman on the pod the other day. This, I wouldn't be surprised if they were to call him back and say, you know what, why don't we do another season like this? Because he's exactly the type of guy that can play a role, a marginal role, and at a very low price, and that can be moved aside if they need to see how a young defenseman is progressing.
Yeah, not only that, he feels responsible to actually help young players and just, you know, help their transition to the NHL. Like, he doesn't feel threatened by young players. That's like, he has the right attitude about it, you know? Like, and we talked about it on the pod a couple of weeks ago. He was quite good on that. But the Canadiens are full of those placeholders. Like, you know, Rem Pitlick, even though Martin St. Louis loves him, I mean, you know, he's basically that. His cousin Tyler is basically that. Laurent Dauphin, Pezzetta. I mean, I don't want to say it, but I mean, you know, Ryan Poehling's kind of entering that realm. You know, it's not quite clear what kind of prospect he is, but we'll see what he turns out as. But, you know, Paul Byron even can be scratched if need be, if you want to see a young player play. There's a lot of guys in the system right now that can fill that role, but I think the Canadiens need to do, and I really do think that this is going to be a priority, is finding other guys like this. Like Cale Klag didn't cut it as a guy like that. You know, William Lagesson is not, you know, he was obviously thrown in a trade, but he's not the type of guy that you want. Like, you want a guy that not only the coach, but that the other players on the team, especially those young players, feel confident going out there and playing with, that they can perform at a certain level and give your team some level of competitiveness. Sorry. And not make it clear that this is, you know, that this is just a placeholder. So, but I think you're right, is that players like that are going to be important if the Canadiens intend on, because the Ottawa Senators example is great. I mean, you look at the way their players have developed, some of their key young players, and it's really gone fantastically well, but using the model that Ken Hughes suggested the Canadians might use. I mean, when you look at Drake Batherson, Josh Norris to a certain extent, Alex Formanton. I mean, these are guys who did that, who got a little bit of time in Ottawa, would go back to Belleville, come back, go back, and then got some playoff action with Belleville as well, which is, you know, we're seeing the Rocket in the playoff right now, which is a benefit to, you know, Jesse Ylönen's going to be playing these playoffs. Emil Heinemann, assuming he gets healthy in time, they have Matthias Norlander coming over to play in the playoffs with the Laval Rocket. And so there's a lot of positives there. But it's interesting to what extent. I was somewhat surprised to hear Kent Hughes sort of pump the brakes a little bit on how drastic they're going to be. I thought they were going to be a little bit, and they might be. Listen, they might wind up doing some pretty severe or drastic things, but everything he was asked about how quickly this is going to go, he gave a strong impression that it's not going to be all that quick. It's not going to be all that long necessarily, but if you're looking for a massive turnaround next season, I think you might be disappointed.
Right. Well, I think that not having sweeping changes is not a bad thing at all. But I think at the same time, it adds to the case of aiming for, you know, the Connor Bedard, Adam Fantilli, that range of high-end prospects for next year's draft. Unless they think that the current group that they have, there's more value to be created out of those guys, and that in effect they are not as bad as they've been this season. And Martin Saint-Louis has been adamant about the fact that he was looking to create value for those players, increase their individual values. Probably it's going to be more of that. And if they want to put themselves in a better situation next year, and if eventually they want to move some contracts, these players have to be in a position where it's not going to cost the Canadians money to do so. But that's all performance-based. So maybe that their evaluation of what they've got right now is that even if we were to copy-paste the same roster next season, we won't be the 32nd team next season. We're going to be better than this. And just because of that, we should not be in the Connor Bedard sweepstakes. Maybe that's how they think, but I think that you cannot both say we're going to take our time, we're not going to make sweeping changes because we don't want to risk our future, and at the same time say, well, we're not going to be taking this opportunity to go after potential guys that could be generational players or at least organizational changing for us. You know, to me, you should have one or the other.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Right. Well, I'm going to play devil's advocate because in theory, like, you know, in principle, I agree with you. You know, you should take one path to the other. Although I do think intentionally going after Connor Bedard is not good either. Like, I don't know how long it's going to take the Arizona Coyotes to get out of this, you know, and leaving aside all the off-ice stuff in Arizona, just from a hockey culture and team culture kind of standpoint, you know, how damaging this was and how demoralizing this was to some of the players that are going to be a part of their future. And not only that, but having players who know fully well that they're only there to fill a spot and collect a paycheck. Like, what how do those players influence the actual players who are part of the future, who are getting paid, or who are obviously there for the long term? How does their development get impacted by playing with players who know they're not, you know, who know that they're just there as mercenaries, basically, and they're being thrown, you know, they're being thrown to the wolves every night to lose games on purpose, almost, you know, I mean, to not quite on purpose, but basically by design, I should say, as opposed to being on purpose. So I don't know if that's good either. Like, if the organization just decides to go scorched earth the way Arizona has, and it's clear that we talked to him back in January, he mentioned the Arizona specifically multiple times as being a route they would not take. But like, if you look at their, you know, Martin St. Louis came in, the Canadiens were 8-30-7. They finished 22-49-11. So that's, you know, 14-19-4. So that's, if you extrapolate that over, and listen, there's a lot of factors involved there. Obviously, the trade deadline gutted the roster. I think they have the potential to be a little bit better than that next season. But if you look at that record, is that not a reasonable expectation of what the Canadiens might do over a full season next season? Maybe a little bit better than that, be just under 500, still wind up with a top 10 draft pick in all likelihood if they finish with a record like that. But be competitive in games, not feel like they're tanking. continued growth for those young defensemen who, if they're shuttling back and forth between Laval, so be it. Continued growth for Suzuki, for Caulfield, for Romanov. I would think Jesse Ylönen would be on this team next season based on what he showed this year. You know, there's some benefits to not doing one or the other, like you suggested, like, and which I don't disagree with again, but I mean, there's benefits to not going that way that are not as tangible and not as easy to identify. And it just has to do with culture and how players feel, how players who are in a competitive environment feel about the grind of the season when you don't feel like the organization has your back, in a sense, you know, like it's there's some damage there that gets done. And I think we've seen it in Buffalo. I think we saw it in Edmonton for a long time. I think they're finally starting to come out of it a little bit. It's unclear to me, at least, how long it takes to get out of that culture where losing is not only acceptable, but is the goal.
Right. Well, and plus, adding to that, and I don't advocate for the Canadiens to go scorch earth here and do what the Coyotes are trying to do. And one thing that really strikes me is that now with all those top five, top 10 protected trades, in a sense, it becomes very difficult for a team that's in the basement to load up on quality draft picks. Because if you look even at the Coyotes for the upcoming draft, so yeah, they're going to have their you know, a top five draft pick. But apart from that, their other two first round picks, they belong to Carolina and Colorado. So they're going to be at the back of the bus. So you're not going to have players that really going to spark a significant change to your organization if you draft, you know, if those guys are drafted 27th, 29th, 30th, whatever. So you still are left with your one high draft pick, and that's what you must count on. So I don't think that now with these top 10 protected trades, I don't think that a team can say, well, I'm going to sell everything, load up on draft picks, and hope that it's going to be quality instead of quantity. The only way to do it is quantity. So I think that there's the Canadiens, even under Marc Bergevin, have done pretty much as far as they could go in terms of loading up for prospects. And we have to see if eventually quantity is going to prevail and there's going to be, you know, a diamond in the rough, someone is going to emerge from that. But when you are in a position where you can bank on the on a top five pick or whatever, especially on the high draft, well, you have to look at the situation and say, okay, well, if we want to go up and down with our young defensemen, if our goalie, even though we would like to have certainty before a certain date, we cannot impose one because it's a medical issue and you cannot put a deadline on that. So we could very well enter next season without clarity. I feel as though there are many items that gather together and call for the Canadians to say, you know what, let's manage another year that could potentially be like this one and be ready to be a competitive team very soon after. Because it's not the Buffalo Sabres. It's certainly not the Arizona Coyotes. They've got good pieces. But mm-hmm. I think that the one element is missing or the one or two elements that are missing is, you know, they need a top six centerman. They'll need a top duo, top two defensemen. But those guys, they're not going to be able to acquire them through trades. And it'll have to come from the draft. And they're not in a position even to get one or acquire one on the free agent market because their ends are tied up financially. So it's I'm really, really intrigued to see where you know Kent Hughes is going with all this. And I'm looking forward to our next sit down with him so we could at least get a bit of clarification. But he's taking a very interesting stance that spontaneously would not be the one I would be taking if I was in his shoes.
Right, but I think you make a good point in the sense that the whole Carey Price situation allows them to do this. And almost doesn't only allow them to do it, almost forces them to do it this way. It's that they can't do anything overly definitive when there's nothing definitive on his status. And that all the I mean, you mentioned free agency. Listen, Kent Hughes has made it clear on multiple occasions that he would be interested in being a player in free agency. He was asked about the center position on Saturday and of his own volition, no one asked him, do you intend on signing a free agent center? He said, you know, when I was an agent, I always sold my centers as saying that they're the most valuable position on the team. There are some centers who are not signed next season, so we'll see what we can do there, or something to that effect. And so, you know, that suggests going after a free agent centerman. And I think we've speculated on this podcast in the past that, you know, there's a guy in Colorado right now who's having a career year and hitting the market at just the perfect time for him. But, you know, Nazem Kadri will be one of the top centers available on the market, is represented by Ken Hughes' former agency, if not himself as the agent. There are some, but again, you can't get into those talks if you don't know if you have $10.5 million or $10.5 million extra to spend this summer or not.
Yeah.
So it's tied into that. But the other thing, so I think that's a great point by you, is that the Carey Price situation really leaves them no choice but to go about it in this kind of wishy-washy sort of mushy middle kind of way, which, you know, generally you don't want teams to do, but they don't particularly have much of a choice. But if you look at, like, when Martin St. Louis got hired, yes, the Canadians were, you know, 8-30. What did I say? 8-30-11, if I'm not mistaken. Sorry. Just going to double check that. 8-30-7. Sorry. But more importantly to me is they had a minus 80 goal differential. Minus 80.
Yeah. Yeah.
So under Martin St. Louis, the record is, you know, 14-19-4, which is a 432 points percentage, which would put them, you know, roughly, well, since Martin St. Louis took over, they're 24th in the league in points percentage. But the key number for me is that their goal differential was minus 19. So they went from a minus 80 team to a minus 19 team, which, you know, that minus 80 team was doing irreparable damage to some of their young players. And we saw it. You know, we don't have to go over the Cole Caulfield, you know, rebirth, but it's not just him. I mean, to me, Romanov's development over the second half of the season was borderline more impressive than Caulfield's, because you saw significant changes in his game and the way, like, he was not skating him. He was not, you know, what the coaching staff was always saying, like, he had to contain his energy. Well, we saw less and less of him being overzealous and skating himself into mistakes. You know, like, he'd kind of reined it in and found a good sweet spot between the good energy that he brings and maybe the not so good energy that he needs to maintain.
But the fact that he played more forced him to manage his energy too. You know, when you're the one getting 23-24 minutes a night, well, you cannot skate into trouble all the time and spend your energies unwisely because you're going to get burned all the time. And I think that it was really a blessing for him that he was given all those minutes because it was an experience in managing that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And I think having Joel Edmondson around, even though they didn't play together, was a great thing. So we finally got to speak to Alexander Romanov at the end of the season. And so, you know, in case fans weren't aware, Romanov was not speaking basically as a policy by the Canadians ever since the conflict in Ukraine broke out. The Canadians had decided that they're not going to expose Romanov to potential questions about the conflict in Ukraine. And I don't think he himself felt very comfortable asking them. And that was the one condition to him coming out and talking at the end of the season was that he not get questions on the situation in Ukraine right now, and which we complied with. And so, but it's a good thing we did get to speak to him because the man is just, his enthusiasm is just, it's incredibly cute sometimes, you know? Like, I mean, he was asked about David Savard at one point. A huge smile hits his face. Oh, he is so awesome. He's so awesome. And he just kind of like, it's just, you know, he has the best answers. And so let's hear from him right now because that answer was really good.
Can you just expand a little bit in Russian or English, like you want, on what it was like for you to play with David Savard at the last few months?
He's an awesome guy. Like, he always support me, always like, always talking with me on the ice, try to teach me a little bit. But he's really awesome guy. Always help me on the ice or in the locker room. He's so good.
So, you know, like that, what you hear in Romanov's voice there is, I think, the embodiment of the benefit of the second half of this season. You know, it's really what players like him, but not only him, you know, I think Jordan Harris took major steps, even though he only played 10 or so games, took huge steps in his, and got a huge head start on his pro career by playing in that environment. And so I think that's kind of the benefit of the mushy middle model, if you will. It's kind of a mouthful, but the Canadians are A, they're forced into it. B, if they can be a competitive team but still wind up with like a pretty good draft pick in the top 10 range, that's not a bad thing. And you get the development of your players. And if there's one thing that came through in Hughes's talk with us on Saturday was how often he mentioned the word development and how important it is. And actually one of his more interesting answers came regarding Martin St-Louis, who he said the Canadians would, not only did he say the Canadians would like to sign him, he said they want to sign him for at least 3 years. When have you ever heard a GM say this about a coach? He said, yeah, well, minimum 3 years for us is what he said. So I was like, okay, that's, you know.
Bruce Boudreau must be pretty jealous right
now. Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Exactly. It's like, why can't I get a GM like that? Jeez. That guy just walked off the bus, you know. This is a brand new coach. His GM wants to sign him for 3 years. I have to take this crappy option. Anyhow. But let's listen to Ken Hughes talk about Martin St-Louis and his role in the development of the Canadiens' young players.
But I also think there's a level of intelligence in today's coach that's required. Emotional intelligence. I hear him talk about that guy needs a lot of touches, this guy doesn't. So there's this ability to understand the individual and be able to go and get the most out of that individual. And that component of it's been impressive to me. And I look forward to, as we kind of bring more sources here into our coaches or provide more information to them, I think there's another level of intelligence in terms of just, it's not just systems or it's not just concepts. It's taking information from this and taking information from your development guy, your analytics people, your management people, and being able to manage it all. And we had a conversation about it, and he said, hey, there's a lot more work to this than I probably realized. But I actually think he's very equipped to deal with those types of things. So, you know, we're excited by what he brought to this team and what he will in the future.
So that's going to be a key factor for this team moving forward, is just development. One last thing I want to touch on before I do want to talk about everything that happened with Guy Lafleur, and so we'll get to that in a moment. But the Jeff Petrie situation is another thing that's very intriguing to me for this offseason, just because Ken Hughes, when asked about, I think I asked him about if he was willing to entertain the possibility of retaining salary on trades, just generally speaking. But, you know, we talked about Hoffman, Armia, all these people, like, you know, if you want to move them, keeping some money would help make that happen, you know? So he didn't seem all that enthusiastic about it, mentioned like, okay, well, if we move a guy and I retain salary, then we have to replace him. Are we really that much better off? And then out of nowhere, all on his own, he said this.
It would depend on what we are acquiring in terms of, if we gain short-term flexibility, what does it allow us to do? Right? We're kind of discussing in abstract instead of in a concrete example. At the end of the day, we have to see where we're going with this group, what players are ready to take on in terms of responsibility. So if we trade somebody away and retain cap flexibility and we got to go replace them with another player and we ultimately save X dollars, what does it do for us? Right? So we're going to explore a lot of different things here this summer, including trading Jeff Petrie, as we promised that we would. That would give us cap flexibility. You know, we have uncertainty around Carey. If he can't play, we have LTI money to work with. You know, so there's a lot of different things that I can't come here today and say, boom, we're doing this. But if we knew more about Carey's situation, or when we know more about Carey's situation, it's going to give us a little bit more of an indication as to what kind of cap flexibility we need or don't. So unfortunately, we have some gray areas here that once we have a better idea as to which way they're going, it'll help us understand where we go.
A few minutes after that, Jeff Petrie comes out and kind of, you know, was asked some pretty blunt and direct questions about, you know, what role his family played in his decision to ask for a trade and whether it was more of a hockey thing. And he was really quite adamant that, no, it was not a family situation. The family situation was separate, that the trade request or the desire to be traded really had almost everything to do with how this team was with Dominique Ducharme, with how this team was playing under Dominique Ducharme. And he did not like the direction of the team and did not want to be playing in an environment like that. And so his opinion on his own future seems to have changed quite drastically with Martin St-Louis, because he is glowing in his praise of how Martin St-Louis deals with individual players. I think we're going to find out how Martin St-Louis is as a head coach of an entire team. What's already really clear is he's very good at working with individual players. Like, he's very good at that. Let's see how he learns how to coach a team. I think that's going to be his next sort of test. And I don't think that's entirely clear if he has a full grasp of that yet, but what he definitely has a grasp on is how to help individual players improve and maximize their game. So on the one hand, you have Jeff Petrie saying, well, I don't want to close the door on this organization. And you have the GM kind of out of nowhere saying like, well, we are going to look to trade Jeff Petrie, by the way, just so you know, that's a way we can save some cap dollars. So how do you see that? He's been very consistent with that, but then so now it seems to be independent from whether Jeff Petrie wants to be traded or not, if you catch my drift. Like, how do you read that?
Well, I think that once he committed himself at saying publicly that he would try to move him, he's gonna stay the course. I'm not ready to say that Petrie's gone for sure. But after, we rarely hear a GM being so emphatic in his intentions towards a player. And I think that it was sparked from a wish from Petrie himself. So now if Petrie has second thoughts, the GM will say, well, listen, man, we're going to do what's best for the team. It was our position before, when you were hoping to be moved. And it's going to be our position still if you have second thoughts about it. So even if Petrie wants to stay, I think that it's a good thing for the Canadiens, because in the event that they don't get what they want for this player, if they don't have the proper return, they could still keep him knowing that they won't have a sulky player in their on their hands. So I think that from that point, from that aspect, I think it's a positive development. But at the same time, I feel as though they're a little bit pot committed when it comes to Jeff Petrie. And a part of me, I hear that, and I'm thinking, wow, it's as though they're already thinking, what are going to be our plan Bs and Cs? And who's going to be that next veteran defenseman that we're going to bring in once we've moved on from Jeff Petrie? I might be wrong, but this is really my impression that I'm taking from this.
Yeah. How about you? One thing about the coaching change and one thing about Jeff Petrie's own change is that since he'd asked for a trade, when he asked for a trade, his trade value was practically zero. Like, he was playing so badly that it would have been very difficult to get anywhere near a fair return for a player of Jeff Petrie's quality back. You know, it would have been basically a dump, you know, like they would have had to have just taken futures, or, you know, there wasn't going to be a fair trade struck with Jeff Petrie playing the way he was under Dominique Ducharme. Since Marty St. Louis took over, Petrie had 21 points in 30 games from February 10th onward. That placed him tied for 24th in defense scoring in the league. So basically top pair production in the NHL. So
among the defensemen who played at least 10 games during that span, in terms of points per game, he's 20th also. So it's
even better. Yeah, exactly. So he's and he did that largely without playing on the power play or not playing a big role on the power play. So like 19 of those 21 points are at even strength. So he did re-up his value and show that he can still be a productive, relatively mistake-free, big minute-eating right shot defenseman who can skate like the wind. And so the interesting thing is that because he started playing that way, he kind of no longer wanted to be traded, but because he started playing that way, he became much easier to trade. So I think from Ken Hughes' perspective, he's like, okay, well, now you're talking. Now you're playing like someone. And remember when we spoke to him in January, this is one thing he said he hoped to accomplish this season was for Jeff Petrie to play himself up to a level where he could realistically trade him. And he was pretty open about it. You know, like he was like, we want to get Jeff Petrie playing the way we know he can, and that would make trading him that much easier. Like he was pretty blunt about that. So I think they're going to do everything they can to trade him. That's how they think they're going to create their cap flexibility, because he is, whether that's at the draft, whether that's at the trade deadline next year, I think that's something they'd like to accomplish. And again, because they're entering a transition year, there's no rush. They could bring Jeff Petrie back. He could play. They could trade him at the deadline. They could not. I mean, it's really, you know, this year means there's no urgency to any of it. But I would think that we have a good chance of seeing a Jeff Petrie trade by the draft. I would think so.
Yeah, me too. And I mean, if he's back, in the event he's back and he plays as well as he did under Martin Saint-Louis, it becomes a very reassuring asset come next trade deadline. So even though, you know, even though he'll be a mid-30s type of guy who at that point will have two seasons and change left on his deal, he might be more of an interesting asset to acquire than he is at this point. Because I'm not sure if the sample size of those 30 games will be enough to reassure everybody that he's truly back. But
yeah, he's got years of sample size. I mean, the outlier is the first half of this season. Like, that's really the one.
I agree, but when you're 34 years old, though, that outlier will scare a lot of people, because they'll say, mm-hmm. well, this is, everybody falls off a cliff at some point. and age catches up, is it that time for Petrie? So there's plenty of time for redemption, and I think that there's not, he's not, we've said repeatedly on this podcast how his skating ability could help him, you know, protect himself from that cliff. But I think that if he was to come back with the Canadiens next season, he might be, it's easy to say, but he might be more of an attractive trade asset later on than he's been this year. But I'm with you totally. I think that there's a, you know, significant possibility that he might be moved. And as much as you seem to see the picture of Nazem Kadri in the tea leaves, well, I see Chris Letang when I think of Petrie's potential replacement. So it's been, I know it's been a, it's a, he's another former client of
he is a former client of Ken Hughes. Yeah, he is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kadri was never a client of Ken Hughes, just to be clear. Kadri never had Ken Hughes as an agent. He just had just the same agency, just so that's clear.
That's right. So anyway, I know that his
name, Chris Letang, Ken Hughes was asked specifically, if you trade Jeff Petrie, do you feel like you'll need to sign a veteran to replace him? And that's where he kind of talked about, you know, not putting so many rookies in, and he said yes, he would be inclined to sign a veteran to replace him. So
that's it, because he cannot
Chris Letang is a veteran.
That's it. And he's on sign for next season.
yes, exactly.
Doesn't have a contract for next season. Yeah, and anyway, that's the sort of move, of decision that they'll have to do on the blue line. They'll give themselves a deadline on that because, you know, even though they would say, oh, we think that this young player would be ready, this other young player, they cannot wait until, in like other seasons where, let's see how things play out at training camp, because you don't want to end up in a situation where, gosh, we think that this player, that player, they all need more seasoning, and we had roster spots open for these guys, and now we have to find other ways to fill it. So I think that it's in their minds, it's going to be potentially two younger defensemen, but certainly not three that are going to be in the on the roster.
No. But I mean, that's not counting Romanov, obviously, because they don't consider Romanov to be a young defenseman anymore. And that that was one of the more striking parts of the season, is when Martin St. Louis considered, when George Harris was making his debut, and he said he'd like to have him on the ice with a veteran. He was asked if, I think I asked him actually, if he considered Romanov a veteran at this point. He's like, yeah, I would say that. Just kind of casually, you know. Just a guy in his basically his second full season in the NHL, you know.
He's a vet.
Yeah.
Hey, man, before we move on to our last topic, I'm curious to have your take on Paul Byron. Everybody wonders, is this it for Carey Price? Is he at the end of the road? Is it the end of his career? What about Byron? Do you think as though he's surely coming back? What's your read on this situation?
My read on his situation is very similar to my read on Gallagher's situation. Like, they are both smaller players who play a pretty hard game. Byron doesn't get enough credit for how good he is battling along the boards, how he does go to dirty areas. Maybe not with the same frequency as Brendan Gallagher, the same effectiveness, but he does it. So they're both smaller guys who have played kind of a hard game for a long time. And so I think, especially in Byron's case, having hip surgery in the offseason, not getting his proper training, having to come back mid-season, having all of that derailed by COVID, first the team getting COVID, then him getting COVID, and all the different ways that impacted his ability to prepare, affected him. So I think in both their cases, I'm willing to give them a pass. And Byron played well when he came back. You know, it's just the fact that he got hurt again that's kind of worrisome. But I think in both their cases, I want to see what a full off season gives them. You know, I think Brendan Gallagher has earned the benefit of the doubt at this point in his career. He insists that with a full off season of training and building his body back up to what he's used to, that he will come back strong and that this season will be looked back on as an outlier. I'm willing to give him that benefit of the doubt because he's earned it. I think Paul Byron said very similar things at the end of season presser, and I think I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt and see how that plays out as well. I hope for his sake that that's the case. I hope that that's what happens, is that it was just a matter of circumstances and you know, hip surgery is not, listen, hip surgery ended Tukarask's career. Like, he tried to come back, it didn't work, and then he just called it quits. That's it. Hip surgery is a tough thing to return from. It's very, very difficult. So let's see. Let's see the sauce. I hope Paul Byron's, you know, he only has 1 year left on his contract. And listen, he knows the reality of the situation. I think he does realize that this could be it for him, but he's not willing to throw in the towel. But it's, I think his situation is far, and Brendan Gallagher's situation is obviously far less precarious than Carey Price's situation. I mean, there's legitimate factors involved in both those guys that would suggest that they're correct, that a proper offseason of training and doing all the things that they would normally do over a full summer will allow them to come back and play a full, relatively healthy season. Like, that's, so that's my take on Paul Byron. But I think, you know, he's got 1 year left on his deal. He's getting up in age as well. You know, he doesn't have limitless time ahead of him, but I still think he's got another good season in him, potentially. You know, I hope he can stay healthy. I hope he deserves to go out on his own terms to some extent and not be forced out by these injuries.
Right. Okay. So, yeah. Okay. So, basically, you put him more in the Gallagher category than in the Price category when it comes to injuries, potentially, you know, risking the end of his career.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just that because the hip surgery legitimately did him good. Like, he actually became a better player as a result of it. You know, his skating came back, his explosiveness came back.
Right.
The fact that it was still causing him to overcompensate on the other side of his body, leading to muscle tears, that's a bit worrisome. But again, let's see what a full off season of preparation and proper maintenance allows him to do. So, yeah, I would put him more in the Gallagher category than the Price category.
Hey, bit of hard news. The Canadians have signed Riley Kidney. They're a second-round pick from last draft. So, first, an entry-level contract for him. So,
yeah, three-year deal. Neat. Yeah, he had a great season in the queue. So, that is an interesting development, I think. He had a really, really excellent season this year. I really liked his training camp, personally. Mm-hmm. I was keeping a running file. You know how we keep a running file of Armia things when Armia is actually playing well, which he was before he left for Finland to deal with a personal matter. But, you know, when he's on his game, there's all these little moments in a game that you can that you notice. And when you start compiling them in one file, they add up and you're just like, wow, it's a lot of little things that make a big impact at the end of the game. Well, training camp, I had a similar file with Riley Kidney. Because he was doing things in scrimmages consistently that jumped out at me, like, this kid's in junior and he's making like NHL level plays, like, and really smart and, like, I want to say spatially aware plays. He had a real, real good concept of how much space he had, how much time he had, and used it to its full potential at playing against NHL players. It was really impressive. Like, I thought he had an excellent training camp. I obviously have not followed his season in the queue, but by all accounts, he's been tremendous. But I just found him to be a really smart, aware, poised player. Considering it was his first NHL training camp, it did not look like it was his first NHL training camp.
No, he looked dynamic, and and I like the comparison with the Armia things, except that kidney thing sounds different. It doesn't have the same ring to it. Yes. I got a kidney thing.
Yeah, kidney stones. We can call them kidney stones. Yeah. I'm sure Riley Kidney has spent his entire life having jokes made based on the fact his last name is Kidney. So we're not going to do that. That's the last time I'm going to make a kidney stone joke. If Riley Kidney, if you're listening, that's the last one. I'm never going to do that again.
That's good.
I promise.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
Which little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
Let's end this with something that personally I felt privileged to experience yesterday. Guy Lafleur's funeral were a thing of beauty, and it was fascinating to talk to so many people that knew him well, that in different terms and in each and their own different way, expressed a very similar portrait of the man. The way that he's being described by his former teammates, by friends, the individual is like everybody had a very, very good pulse on who he was, obviously, and it's not as though there were like those you know, free compliments or run-of-the-mill compliments you would address somebody. There was this is a larger-than-life figure that everybody was happy to bring back to earth at the same time and say, well, he might have been larger-than-life, but he was really a in French, we would say terre-à-terre, someone who's at the same level of everybody else. Yes. In his greatness. And I think that that's really one of the things that people appreciated the most with, because you're in front of a guy who had would have every reason, especially during his career and with all the fame that followed him after his career, to have, you know, to have the big head or to at least give himself a little bit of space between him and the public, just in order to protect his own little individual bubble. Uh-huh. And Guy Lafleur, contrary to a lot of famous personalities, really did not do that. And that's and I think that people thought that it was fascinating and appreciated him even more for that, because he was out there sharing his success and sharing his greatness with everybody that he met, with his close friends, with his acquaintances, with his family, and with also just the average Joe that he would meet on the street. So I think that, and living this moment yesterday, having talking to so many people, I think that it was a beautiful curtain call for someone who, you know, it's just unfortunate that we're losing him.
It was quite striking to hear Steve Shutt talk about visiting him 3 weeks ago and how well he seemed to be doing. You know, he said he's, you know, he was really, really sharp is how Shutt described it, and that he looked good, and that he left there with his son saying that, you know, we know how this is going to end, but it's not going to happen anytime soon. Doesn't seem like it, at least. And then 3 weeks later, or 2 weeks later, I guess, he passed away. And so, at the age of 70, which is obviously way too soon. And it's, you know, that same cathedral hosted Jean Béliveau's funeral. We've heard on and on this week, because it's true, about just the lineage of Maurice Richard to Jean Béliveau to Guy Lafleur. It was great to hear Patrick Waugh talk about, because he basically took that baton from Guy Lafleur to a certain extent, didn't kind of handle it the same way, is not kind of in the same sphere of being an ambassador, let's say, for the Canadians and for the Quebec people, I guess, to a grander extent, the way that Lafleur was, the way that Béliveau was, and the way somewhat reluctantly Richard was. But still, to hear him talk about, you know, his first training camp with the Canadians and Guy Lafleur making a point of coming and tapping him on the pads and saying, "Welcome to the Canadians, kid," you know, that's a baton that kind of went. And it's amazing that this franchise has just been blessed with these local Francophone heroes, amazing players, yeah, who were able to carry and this is maybe something that Waugh didn't do quite as well, but players who were amazing players, but were also able to carry that extra added burden, not only carry it, but carry it like way above their heads and do it like with grace and style and sincerity and just class, the way particularly Béliveau and Lafleur did. And they really, really lifted a people, you know? And it's just hearing his teammates talk about him over the last week, not just at the funeral, but over, you know, over the last X number of days, really drives home the point that in order to do that, you got to have it. You know, you got to, it's got to be genuine. And that's what you got with Guy Lafleur. Everything he did was out of a genuine desire to either make his teammates feel welcome or make, you know, the average Joe on the street feel special. When he signed an autograph, he often asked for someone's name so he could personalize it. Just the sheer number of Lafleur jerseys who came through the Bell Center to visit not only Guy Lafleur in his coffin, but obviously his wife and his children and the rest of his family. There were so many Lafleur jerseys, and so many of them were signed. It was just incredible to watch. Like, I walked up and down the line at the Bell Center on Sunday, and you saw Lafleur jerseys that were clearly from the 1970s. Like, they were frayed and yellowing, and like, it was just like they were old. And you saw Lafleur jerseys that might have been like a year old, or like 4 or 3 years old, or whatever, and everything in between. And I'd say half of the ones I saw were signed by Guy Lafleur. honestly, it was astonishing. And so it just showed really how blessed the Canadians have been, how Quebec society at large has been to have these kinds of role models who are genuine role models, people that you can actually aspire to be like, not because they're great hockey players, but because they were great men, like Guy Lafleur was. And I think it's pretty unanimous. It's rare that you see total unanimity on someone that he's unanimously loved, and Guy Lafleur was unanimously loved.
And, you know, I know that whenever there's talk of the next big French player or the next big Quebec star, it's easy for people to delve into political debate and make it a language thing or whatever. But it's really in these occasions when you mention, you know, passing the baton between Richard to Béliveau to Lafleur, then to Roy, it's just that craving that people have that there's going to be continuity, that there's going to be another that could potentially prolong the lineage. And and until that's done, people keep their fingers crossed and say, well, when will we see our next Guy Lafleur? And people are craving for that, craving for a local hero. And I think that there's nothing wrong about that.
There is nothing wrong about that. But I will say this, is that what Richard did and what Béliveau did and what Lafleur did, what they all contributed in doing is creating a place in Quebec where I don't think the Quebecois people need that anymore. Yes, they would love to have that. They would love it. But I think when Richard did it, they needed it. They needed someone to look up to and be like, okay, we can aspire to great things. Look at what he's doing on the world stage. He is one of us. We can do great things as well. When Béliveau did it, I still think the Quebec population needed it. You know, Quebec society was very different at the time. And they needed to look up to these to greatness, and so that they too can aspire to greatness. And I think Patrick Roy said it great in the eulogy about Guy Lafleur, is that he showed that not only can you dream big, but you must dream big. You have to do that. You cannot go half measures. You have to dream big, like Guy Lafleur did. And he showed that to the population. And I would say that I would like to think, and perhaps I'm wrong, but I would like to think that Quebec society has reached a place where the population doesn't need that as much. They should know by now that they can aspire to great things. And Guy Lafleur was a part of that. Jean Béliveau was a part of that. Maurice Richard was a big part of that. Their legacy, in my eyes, is that the Quebec population doesn't need that. They would love to have it, but it's a bonus. I feel like the confidence they created here as a people, I think is their greatest legacy, in the sense that they've made it so that figures like that aren't necessarily needed anymore.
Yeah, that's possible. But at the same time, the whole team is linked to the identity of the community. And so if you want to tie the team to the community, well, you want to have at least one main figure that connects with that community in the same way. And maybe that if you say, well, the community might not need that player anymore, maybe that they don't need that tie to the with the team as much as they once did too. You know,
I don't think they did. I don't think they do. The team doesn't hold the same place culturally and societally in Quebec as it did when they were winning Stanley Cups and when Guy Lafleur was in his heyday. I think we would both agree on that. It's not the same. Sure. It's not the same thing.
For sure. Yeah. But I think maybe there's nostalgia in it that say, well, can it come back to that? You know, and maybe that hoping to get the next Guy Lafleur is just as an utopia as it is to hope that the Canadians will one day return to their, you know, to their legendary days where they can win two or three Stanley Cups in a row. I don't know.
Well, I mean, it's just, I mean, listen, you look at, I think, you think of Guy Lafleur, the knowledge that he was taking the baton from Jean Béliveau. Everyone knew it. He knew it. It was obvious. Béliveau retired. Lafleur arrived the very next season. Like, it was literal passing of the torch. And, you know, listen, he struggled with it for a couple of years. He did not come busting out of the gates. It took him some time. And then when he found it and he maintained it for a very long time and for the second half of the 1970s, Guy Lafleur was the best hockey player in the world. Like, and it's not really up for much debate. You know, I think some people could debate, but it's pretty well understood that Guy Lafleur was the best hockey player in the world from, you know, 1975 to 1979, let's say. Just the type of person it takes to be able to do that, to withstand the pressure that comes with being the next Jean Béliveau. You know, just here, I mean, listen, when they traded for Jonathan Drouin, you know, top three pick of the draft, supremely talented, had some good playoff runs with Tampa, was still very young. This was the intent. Yeah. This was what Marc Bergevin wanted to acquire. He wanted to acquire a player that he felt could take on that burden of being the player that ties the team to the community, to create that, not be Guy Lafleur, but play the Guy Lafleur role to a certain extent. Have someone that your fans can identify with who is a star player on your team. And Jonathan Drouin arrived and said, I am ready for this. I am not only willing, I'm eager to be that person, to embrace that pressure and use it to fuel me. And did everything right at the start. Immediately entered into an agreement with the Shim, and then also got linked with Guy Lafleur to raise money for the hospital. Did everything right and was sincere and genuine in his desire to do so. And it eventually crushed him. Really eventually crushed him. And so that just and I think that he's a very confident young man. And so I think that just shows the extent of why this desire to find the next one is ultimately counterproductive. I feel it ultimately hurts the team, and it ultimately doesn't permit the team to create that link with the community because the pressure is so great. And I don't think today's athlete, and I don't think today's world is as lends itself as well to that kind of thing happening.
Yeah, because you put too much stock into one individual. You ask him to carry more than he necessarily should.
Yeah.
And it's quite amazing that Guy Lafleur was able to do it. And that what he represented.
Also, he also played with 9 Hall of Famers.
Yes, he did. Yes. That's true. Yeah. He was one of the boys.
Yeah.
And then after he retired, he understood what he meant, the symbol that he was, and he kept his duty for the rest of his life. So he extended that way well beyond his playing career. But that's why a guy like that ends up with a state funeral. Because they're the exception. It's not somebody. This is not someone that you're going to get in next year's draft.
No,
it's an exceptional
and I think
among exceptions.
Ron Fournier said it best when he was like, "When are we going to ever do this again?
Yeah.
Who is the next person that's going to create this scene that we've seen? You know, the 2 days at the Bell Center, the state funeral at the cathedral." All the dignitaries, all the pomp and circumstance, you know, streets being shut down in downtown Montreal, helicopters flying overhead, live television coverage. Like, I mean, it's a legitimate question. When will we ever experience that again? I'm not sure. I don't know. At least for at least for a hockey player.
At least for hockey, yeah. I can think of someone in the arts business, but when it comes to hockey, no.
Yeah,
no. That's it. All right. So, well, that was a long one. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. I hope you enjoyed that podcast. Don't forget to sign up to The Athletic. If you haven't done so yet, you can go to theathletic.com/athletic support and get a rebate, a discount on the first year of your subscription. So make sure to do so. Plenty of coverage. Obviously, the Canadians are not there, but the playoffs are underway, and there's tons of content on The Athletic related to the playoffs. And obviously, even though the Canadians are entering their offseason, Arpin and I are going to continue writing a ton of stuff. And as for the podcast, I would suspect we'll still be back next week.
We'll probably be back next week, and then we're not going to go weekly during the offseason, but we're going to do some draft prep. So we'll have a couple of draft podcasts at some point. And obviously then, you know, so we'll be back periodically over the course of the off season. I don't know how regular of a schedule it'll be, but we'll be around. It just might not be quite as regimented as it has been during the season.
Last year, we said the same thing last off season, but it was so newsy that we ended up pretty much,
we ended up doing more podcasts than we normally do. Yeah,
exactly.
So we'll see what happens.
All right. Thanks again, everybody, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye. How you're fired up, but why don't you bring that sort of energy when we've pushed record button?
Oh, wow. Jeez, you leave for 3 weeks. How do you know what I've been doing for three weeks, you? I've been bringing major energy to the podcast, man. Jeez. Guy waltzes in from Australia and starts sitting on my podcast game, for crying out loud. Fuck, the hell?
Okay, let's get started.
Okay.
Enough of that stupid silliness.
This is a serious
stop goofing around. I know. We are serious professional podcasters. Let's do some podcasting. Crying out loud. Okay, I am recording.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank goodness. Hello, everybody. Welcome to The Athletic Support, your podcast on the Montreal Canadiens. I am Marc-Antoine Godin, back from... Okay, I'll start that over.
All right. All right. Yeah, it's okay.
Okay.
It's okay. We got all day, man. It's all good.
Yeah, all it's okay. We got